A Future Made in Australia, The Disinformation Wonderland, and Solar Cars. This is The Week on Wednesday. Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am your co-host, Ben Davison, and if my voice sounds a little bit off, I apologise. I'm still trying to figure out what's going on with my body and my illness, and I appreciate everybody's patience as we are making our way back onto the airwaves. I am joined, as always, by the great, the glorious, the best-selling author of QAnon and On, A Short and Shocking History of Internet Conspiracy Cults, which will be particularly relevant to one of our topics today, as well as the hit playwright behind A Fool in Love that was recently on at the STC, and of course, Banging Denmark, which he's currently on at the Finborough in London. So if you are one of our expat listeners in the UK, we have a surprisingly large number of you, get along to the Finborough and check out this hysterical play by my wife, your friend, and the woman holding my dog, Van Badham. How are you, Van?
Balancing the dog on my leg. I've got to say he's picked a particularly uncomfortable position for me to record this podcast. So if you hear any screaming, everybody, it's just my thigh giving way.
Well, talking about giving way, we seem to finally have a Labor government that is giving away the old neoliberal trickle-down Friedmanite free market economic nonsense.
Yay!
That has been proven.
Oh, what a feeling. We're dancing on the ceiling.
Well, it's been proven not to work.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
It exists.
Friedmanite economics does not work. Love it. I just love the fact that's a fact now. It's not like, oh, you crazy lefties and your wild ideas. It's like demonstrable fact, friends.
Well, it exacerbates inequality. It makes homes unaffordable. It consolidates wealth into the hands of the already wealthy. And there's no amount of nonsense that can prove otherwise. And in fact, as Anthony Albanese and Jim Chalmers and the whole Labor government have been proving, is if you put that to one side and go with a jobs first, higher wages, constraining the profiteering.
Greed.
Constraining government.
I love
waste.
An anti-greed policy.
It's worked really well. Inflation is coming down. Employment is going up. There was a slight tick up in unemployment, but we're talking about going from 3.7 to 3.8%. People might not remember, but under the Liberals, unemployment at 5% was considered good. That's tens of thousands of Australians who were out of a job, and extra tens of thousands of Australians. What Labor has done now is announce a Future Made in Australia van.
Yes, a Future Made in Australia is the name of the policy suite for the Labor government's integrated economic plan, not just looking at employment, but also looking at manufacturing and local supply and all the kind of fun macroeconomic factors that Ben and I get really jolly about.
Well, I think it's about jobs today, jobs tomorrow, and jobs for our kids. It's about workers having good employment with good wages, and it's about Australia determining what we make here, what we need here, not boardrooms in New York or London or Silicon Valley who've never come to this country, have never met the workers that they are prepared to lay off just to squeeze an extra dollar into their pocket. You know, and it's so amazing to see this debate play out because you've got the old.
Because what we're talking about is manufacturing policy.
Yeah.
This is part of this suite of economic reforms is that the government is going to support local manufacturing.
Yeah.
Building things.
And it's going to be in things where we do have advantages. So it is in things like renewable energy. It is in things where we already have the critical minerals. You know, we already dig it out of the ground. How do we now process it? How do we use it here? It's in things like agriculture. Australian farmers are among the most productive and efficient farmers in the world. How do we support that? How do we grow that? You know, it's not about just corporate tax cuts, which of course, you know, if anybody watched Insiders, they'll probably be as disappointed as I was, Van, to see David Spears talking to Jim Chalmers as though the only thing that matters when it comes to attracting investment or building the economy is the corporate tax rate. And it's like the corporate tax rate is the last thing companies decide on. If you can't get a product to market, if you can't build your product efficiently, if you can't pay your staff properly.
If your workers don't want to work there.
If your workers don't want to work there, if you can't get access to skilled labor, then it doesn't matter what the tax rate is. You ain't got a business, son.
No, you ain't got a business, son. It's so interesting because I am a big fan of David Spears.
I know you are.
Because I think he is a brilliant interviewer. I think he is extremely sharp. I think the way that he evaluates a conversation, I think he has a preternatural ability to detect when a politician is lying to him. And I think his skills are fantastic. But I get, David, if you're listening, I get frustrated that he seems to be poorly politically socialized.
Yeah.
And you can tell that from the guests that come on to Insiders and the kind of frame that he's in. I mean, obviously David Spears was at Sky before he was at the ABC. And like I said, I foreground this by saying he is an exceptional journalist. He is one of the best journalists in the country and a phenomenal interviewer. And I cannot tell you how difficult those skills are. They are very hard. And unfortunately, they are more a feature of talent than training, being able to do that. But it is extremely weird to see somebody with that advanced skill set think that the only economic model that encourages business is the rate of corporate taxation. And I mean, if you were at Sky for 15 years, I can maybe get that. But friend, there are other things that we can do in the economy that create favorable business conditions and encourage markets. And, you know, I mean, it's crazy. Like, I have been to some of the highest taxing countries in the world. I had the great privilege of doing some work in Sweden. You know, like, I've spent a lot of time in Finland, Denmark. These are very, very high taxing countries. And it's amazing. You're not going to believe this. They have domestic industries.
Yeah.
And also, multinationals go there. And they have multinationals of their own. Yeah. Because it's not about the corporate tax rate.
No.
It's about the fact that they've got healthy markets and really efficient production processes and a really great place to live with cradle-to-grave welfare. Very easy to get your high-skilled American employees to maybe do some time working in Sweden when it's like, oh, yeah, healthcare here is free or minimal cost and, there's childcare and amazing education system and it's clean and the roads and you can do all your recycling at the supermarket. Like, it's really funny that we just pretend the high-taxing, extremely stable, pro-democracy bulwark of everything great in the world doesn't exist when it comes to the corporate tax rate conversation.
Well, it is.
I mean, you lived in Norway.
Yeah, and it's the same. Like, the reality is government can set it can pull a whole bunch of levers that will set frameworks for how the economy works. It can be more or less interventionist. You know, it can do things like set up a $2 billion program to kickstart green hydrogen, $1 billion for solar panel supply chain manufacturing, $4 billion for the processing of critical minerals. Like, it can provide direct cash supports. It can provide, yes, tax relief. It can provide labor support by, like they're doing with free TAFE. All of these things are about creating a more prosperous and productive Australia. Now, yes, some companies will profit from that. That's fine. But workers overall will benefit as well because wages will go up as productivity goes up. And we should be really, really clear about some of these things, Van, because, you know, they talk about the kind of priests and priestesses of the Productivity Commission who slam this stuff as protectionist and taking us backwards and will ruin the economy and it'll drive down the standard of living because it'll increase the cost of imported goods. Other countries are already doing these sorts of programs. America's got a huge...
Don't be frustrated.
Yeah, America's got a huge program of this. China's got a program like this. You know, the EU has programs like this. And quite frankly, you know, it's about power in the economy when it comes to how you raise standard of living. And Labor's already putting in place those mechanisms through proving the power of workers. So the union movement has just struck, quite recently, I think in the last week or so, a multi-employer agreement in, believe it or not, something we already manufacture, air conditioning. So we do manufacturing in this country. It may come as a surprise to people, but we do it. Air conditioning, probably not surprising given how hot this country gets. You know, and this has led to 26% increase in wages across a number of manufacturers in this sector. Now, supporting the manufacturing sector means supporting those workers. It means having well-paid workers, often in regional centres. You know, myself coming from Ballarat, you know, we've got people who make caravans, who make truck trailers.
Paint.
Windows. These are
Mars bars.
Mars is a multinational, multi-billion dollar company. You know, keeping them here is good for our economy. Now, we do want them to pay the proper rate of tax. We should also keep in mind
that if workers are being paid properly and there are good jobs being developed in the country, if there's targeted investment in solar manufacturing, lithium batteries or anything else, you will have more people who can afford to buy more Mars bars.
Yeah, but we should also remember that when we talk about these companies, whether they're domestically grown or whether we're encouraging them to stay, and there was a good example Albo gave of a domestic solar panel company that if it hadn't been provided with support would have gone to the United States because the United States was trying to poach them to get them to go to the US. These are in-demand industries for security reasons, for the energy transition, for the jobs they create. Now, while people say, oh, we can't pick winners and losers, I just want to remind people that it was only 2 years ago we had a Liberal national government, and their entire decade in power, they picked winners and losers. They picked gas companies. They picked oil companies. They picked dodgy offshore detention centres.
Job service providers.
They picked job service providers, right. And they funneled
NDIS platforms.
Billions and billions. Yeah, Mabel, which made absolutely no help during the pandemic when it came to aged care, but got paid millions of dollars. Almost every winner they picked, if you like, who got money from them was actually a loser for the taxpayer. In this
$2 billion to Qantas.
$2 billion to Qantas. Wow.
No commissions. Oh my God. Well, they sacked their workforce.
Illegally sacked their workforce. This is my point. You know, all these.
Oh, you're just picking winners and losers. How dare you pick the Australian people to be the winners?
Yeah, and that's the point. Labor is picking the Australian people.
That we let into the Qantas chairman's lounge.
Instead of picking either multinationals or corporations where the money goes to the executives or offshore private equity funds, you know, we're actually picking the Australian people. I want to just come back to gas because we've got massive gas companies in this country, massive, you know, and for a decade, for longer than a decade, we've been subsidising them. Same with oil. You know, we've been subsidising them. We've been giving them rebates. And that's a subsidy, right? Rebates is another lever that we can pull. Governments have consistently pulled that lever to help gas and oil develop in this country.
Yeah, because what this planet really needs is more gas and oil.
But let's be really clear. Gas and oil is now developed in this country. We are now the second largest, if not the largest exporter of gas. And yet gas prices in this country are high. So all of that neoliberal nonsense about, oh, well, if you put Australia first, if you make a future for Australia, if the future is Australian made, then it's going to have a negative impact on the consumer. Well, neoliberal trickle down Friedmanite economics has cost Australia billions and billions of dollars. It has cost the consumers tens of thousands of dollars in higher energy prices, in higher subsidies to billion-dollar companies. And here's the thing. Does anyone really think that Chevron Australia, the board of Chevron Australia, is doing anything that Chevron, the massive American multinational corporation, doesn't already approve of? Like, the idea that some of these companies are, well, we've got to back them because they're doing Aussie jobs. They're doing Aussie jobs because they're getting subsidies. They're doing Aussie jobs because they're getting subsidies, and this is where the oil and gas is. And if they want to go and find oil and gas another 20,000 feet under the sea, it'll cost them five times as much to get out, and no one gives them a subsidy for, good luck to them. A future made in Australia is about saying that form of economic model, that form of economic
is not serving us, and it's also killing the planet. I mean, and this is what's really great about the Future Made in Australia policy suite, is that it is looking at things like renewable energy. Oh my God, actually using the lithium that we have here that can be mined in highly regulated conditions with full heft of Australian democracy and the protections that we as a people expect governing the way that it is extracted. I know that lithium mining is not ideal, but it is better than the alternative, which is burning to death. The idea that these kind of targeted interventions, that we are building jobs for former resource communities around the infrastructure of climate transition, is fantastic. That's exactly what we're supposed to be doing. That's what we elect governments do, so they can take collective decisions in our collective interest and deliver, this is crazy, collective outcomes that maybe do more than one thing at a time. Can you imagine?
Well, this is why I always say that.
Thanks, Jim.
The Made in Australia policy is really about jobs today, jobs tomorrow, and jobs for our kids. You know, people used to talk about transition and the energy transition, all this dislocation, how many jobs would be lost, all these huge numbers get thrown around, and it becomes quite frightening. The reality is what this government has done is it has created more jobs than any government in its first 2 years, I think pretty much since Federation. It's over 1,000 jobs a day are being created as we speak. These policies are about continuing that process. It's about continuing to build on the advantages that we have. And we do have advantages. We have advantages in minerals. We have advantages in sunshine, our location near markets in Asia. We have good educational standards. We do need to invest more in our public school system, and we should all be backing the For Every Child campaign. And we know there are problems with private education being overfunded, which we'll get to in another episode. But, you know, now is the time to join your union, folks. The union movement has been pushing for this for decades, to say Australians should have our future in our own hands. We shouldn't be reliant on whether it's the US or China or a cabal of, you know, neo-Friedmanite priests and priestesses.
Neo-Friedmanite fizzlers, am I right?
Absolute fizzlers, telling us not to touch the levers of the economy because the quote-unquote market will sort it out. Well, the market doesn't sort it out.
Yeah, if the market could sort it out, there wouldn't be a climate crisis, guys.
It's about power.
If the market could sort it out, there wouldn't be poverty.
And if you want power in your workplace, you need to join your union. You go to australianunions.org.au/WOW. That's W-O-W. Stands for the week on Wednesday. Obviously, we're very happy for people to be joining through that link. It's absolutely vital that we understand this.
Yeah, and can I make the point as well, like in terms of what does a Labor government look like? Like, what is the point of difference? And the point of difference is, you know, the way that the climate debate, the climate, you know, screaming and discord in this country has gone on since the election of Tony Abbott and beforehand, which is an extraordinary thing to think any of us survived, but we are still here. There's this idea on one side, and you've seen this around flashpoints in the climate wars, like at Adani, which was, yeah, just leave it in the ground, like just stop it all now. And it's like, that's awesome. That's a really great demand. Yes, we absolutely need to phase out fossil fuels or we will die. What's your plan? Yeah. It's like Ben has this saying, and I'm sure we've quoted it on this program before, ideas are worth nothing. What is your plan? Like, what does it actually, where are the points of resistance? Why did people support Adani? Because they thought they would get jobs there, and jobs are important to them because they lived in towns with a 20% youth unemployment rate. Like, how do we actually do that? How do we bring those communities with us so we can leave this garbage in the ground? And, you know, so you have that Green's position of the, oh, yeah, man, just stop it. I've arrived here in my Tesla to tell you everything you want is wrong. Or you have the Liberal position, which is to deny the climate thing is even happening or it's out of our control or, you know, God will sort it out. And it, both of these positions imply that what's directly in front of us is someone else's problem. I'm rather grateful that the Labor government of Anthony Albanese is like, well, let's actually solve the problem by having an industrial strategy.
And this, there's, you know, an issue here for the opposition too, right? Because they've been more than happy to lock us into decades-long defence deals that cost billions, hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, which, frankly, I don't think anybody really wants nuclear submarines. I don't necessarily think Anthony Albanese wants nuclear submarines either.
I just want to be on record saying I do not want nuclear submarines.
No, and I think, you know, the Morrison government in its dying days did these deals
to landmine the incoming Labor government.
Absolutely. You know,
they do it every time, by the way, young people, every single time.
We had shipmaking capabilities here in Australia. We want to have shipmaking capabilities. We are an island nation, for heaven's sake. We need the capacity to build and flag Australian ships. Ask anyone from the Maritime Union of Australia what happens when ships are flagged from countries where there are no labour standards. Not only do you get underpaid workers, unsafe work environments.
You get sinking ships.
You get sinking ships. You get murders. You get all sorts of horrific things happening. You know, but the Liberals now, having, you know, created this paranoid defence mindset, are now also spruiking, having gone from climate change doesn't exist, and now spruiking nuclear as the answer. You know, at the same time as saying they won't support the future Made in Australia policy, but somehow or another they want us to import at the cost of billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars, nuclear energy, which will have to come from either America or Japan. That's the reality. You know, these people are off their rockers. You talk about picking winners and losers. They want to build nuclear power plants, you know, outside Noosa and Newcastle and in Western Sydney and in the outskirts of Perth. You know, this is...
But not in their own seats.
Not in their own seats.
No, not in their own seats. So, I mean, the question was put to them, would you accept a nuclear reactor in your own seat? And there
not one
has
of them
been
said
a consistent
yes.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are better places to put it, like where those other people live, those dirty peasants who we don't like.
You know.
I want to be very clear because the overarching, where we are with the modern centre-right, and it's crazy to think that a party led by Peter Dutton is centre-right, but the world is a challenging place. The modern centre right has sort of abandoned the old, you know, the tactics of superior policy across a shared consensus, which was the way that this used to work. Even John Howard, who I absolutely just loathe, and living through the Howard era, which was obviously horrendous, there was a fundamental, despite the fact that policies he pursued were quite radical and they were culturally radical, there was a fundamental recognition of a shared reality in Australia. And it was interesting that, you know, they didn't dismantle Medicare as much as they really wanted to, and they didn't dismantle superannuation, even though ideologically they absolutely were committed to destroy it.
Yeah. They did undermine those
things.
They
undermined those things.
They weakened them.
They did as much as they could get away with.
Yeah.
But we existed in a shared reality. And, in fact, what we know about centre-right governments in this country is that they learnt from Menzies onwards. I mean, Menzies hated the full employment policy.
Yeah.
Went against all of his, you know, superiority instincts. But they kept it because it kept them elected.
Yeah.
Because if it was popular, they kept it. The idea that you would make a rational adjustment in a consensus policy environment is not the tactic that the modern centre-right around the world is pursuing. That's not what's happening. What we're doing is we're having constant culture wars that are about identity and they're about a form of tribalism that is based in whatever the other side wants is bad because they're not like us.
Yeah.
Either you're like us or you're not like us. The things that are us are all of these, you know, criteria that define us.
Yeah.
And nuclear energy, let's be very clear, is absolutely a cultural issue. It has nothing to do with the efficiency of the power generated, because it's not efficient. It's got nothing to do with economic savings, because the economic case for nuclear doesn't see it. It's incredibly expensive. It is unbelievably dangerous. As well, we know, we keep getting told nuclear power is safe, and yeah, nuclear accidents.
Can I just say, if nuclear stacked up financially, do we really think that Woodside, Santos, AGL would not have already turned their lobbying efforts to trying to get nuclear taken off the banned list? Because I can tell you that they have huge teams of people who spend vast amounts of money lobbying governments every single day for things that will make them profit. What they don't do is waste their time lobbying for things that will lose them money.
Yeah.
You know, and these companies are not interested in building nuclear power
even
plants.
Though they are the companies with the capacity to do so.
That's right. So you're absolutely right, Van. We've gone from having policy debates about what is in the best interests of the Commonwealth of Australia and the people of the Commonwealth, to how do we define our tribe? And that's what Peter Dutton is doing, is he's trying to define his tribe. He's I don't think he's doing a particularly good job at it, quite frankly. And if you look at the fact that the by-elections that he's lost, and even the by-election in Cook, where there was no Labor candidate, which, frankly, I would have liked to have seen one.
Yes, Ben and I are big fans of Simon Earle. But
it does lend itself now. People are saying that the election result in Cook lends itself to a Teal candidate coming in and sweeping away the Liberal. Because what does it mean to be Liberal? Does it mean that you've got to support all of these nonsense, crazy ideas about nuclear energy and not building solar panels here, but buying them from China.
And not creating jobs for Australians.
And
not standing up for Australian values in labour supply chains. I was outraged to see at least one commentator, maybe there were more, but I got too angry to read on, which does happen even in an information curious household such as this one. That was like a progressive case against the Made in Australia. The future Made in Australia. There is no progressive case. I'm an environmentalist. I would like the infrastructure of climate transition, renewable energy, to be built here in a way where it is regulated, and I know where jobs are being created, and where, you know, there are democratic processes that can affect the way the production is managed, and that revenue will go back into the economy. And I do not understand why you would have any kind of opposition to that if you associated yourself with a progressive pro-humanist position. I mean, it's certainly not a Labourist or Socialist position, because Labourists and Socialists really love jobs, like think jobs are great. I think jobs and the equity of the working class in the economic environment should be built.
And decent work is important here. You know, we've got a modern slavery framework in this country, which frankly is not achieving the aspirations of those who advocated for it, myself among them.
In labour supply chain from
which was
overseas.
Supposed to be about identifying labour supply chain issues. You know, we know that there are companies that are headquartered in Australia that are manufacturing overseas using modern slavery techniques. And quite frankly, there's very little that anybody can do about it. What having a future made in Australia does is it takes that risk out of the supply chain. It takes the sovereign risk out of the supply chain, so we can't be cut off because China suddenly decides it's going to cut us off, which was obviously something during the pandemic everybody got very worried about. We're not reliant on very ethically questionable, downright disgusting behaviours of corporations. We're not reliant on the benevolence of a board based in New York to keep production going. These are the sorts of things that we should be proud to say.
And
as a nation, we have taken control of our future. We have our jobs now. We're building more productivity into our economy so that we have better paid jobs into the future, and our children will be able to enjoy a clean, sustainable, productive, higher standard of living than we are now.
Yeah, exactly. Not to mention, I just can't get over the idea that a policy suite that says let's shorten supply chains and let's control employment conditions, meaning that the people who do this work will be paid properly and fairly, and the environmental cost is minimized, and there's an additional environmental outcome. Like, what is the problem here? What is the actual problem here? What, this terror that next time you buy a washing machine, it will be $50 more? Or like, it's this sort of weird, I sort of like things the way they are, but I'm really progressive. And I'm like, yeah, not really though.
It's the ideological indoctrination that's occurred over the last 40 to 50 years, and it needs to be unstitched. And you can see it with the people who are coming out, you know, people from the Productivity Commission, people who have been swallowing this Kool-Aid for such a long time that they actually still can't believe that we are right now, today, in a situation where unemployment has a 3 in front of it, wage growth has 4s and 5s in front of it, and inflation has a 4 in front of it and is declining. They can't understand that. It doesn't register because all of their theory, all of their ideology says that shouldn't be possible. So they're actually denying reality. And in the process of denying reality on that, they also have to deny the reality that we can actually have some sovereign capability to build things that we need here, that we can choose an economic pathway that allows our people to get the benefits or more of the benefits of our resources, of our labor, of our productivity than people who sit in boardrooms, whether it be London or Paris or New York or Silicon Valley, wherever it is, to distribute to their executives and shareholders.
The idea of Silicon Valley controlling my life or your life or any Australian's life more than they do now, can I say, just frankly, is a horror movie.
So let's support Australian. Let's support Australian IT. Let's support Australian software development. Let's support
high-end manufacturing, technological development. Let us
research and development
govern through the principle of do not waste a brain.
Yeah.
You know, that's the motto of the Finnish education system. I think I've said it on the show before, that the Finns looked at their little country in Northern Europe and went, what have we got apart from a lot of snow? And they went, we've got brains, and we will develop our greatest resource, which is the education of our population. And that's why the Finnish education system is the best in the world. And it's targeted resource management.
And I think we're seeing with the For Every Child campaign and the actions of the Australian Education Union and the state education ministers banding together, saying it's not good enough for us to underfund public schools. And I know you've said many times, and I agree with you, it's not good enough to overfund private schools while we underfund public schools, you know, that we do have to reform how we provide university education. And Albanese's given some hints that something might happen with that in the budget. Free TAFE has been a huge success because, yes, we do need, you can't just import a carpenter to come and fix the wall. Like, you've got to actually have localized skill base to do work locally. These are common sense and logical things and observable. They're 100% scientifically observable, unlike the philosophical, ideological nonsense that we've been trapped in under the coalition since John Howard, really, which basically sort of imagined this invisible magician floating above the world as though it was just one giant farmer's market, picking and choosing bits to buy and sell and setting the price of bread in India as though it would impact the price of bread in California.
You know, that's a core, there's a core neoliberal text. I think it's called the everlasting or never-ending bread machine. And it was because one of the reasons why all of this nonsense caught on, the neoliberal nonsense, was they ran a targeted cultural project. Yeah. Politics flows downstream from culture. And the neoliberals of the post-war period, through their think tanks, places like the IPA and the Centre for Independent Studies in Australia, they toured Milton Friedman like a rock star and made like crazy alternative movies about how like radical and cool he was. He was an absolute nut, by the way.
Yeah.
And they also published children's books and they made board games. I don't know if any of you ever played Poleconomy.
I have played Poleconomy.
Poleconomy was designed by a neoliberal think tank.
It's fun, but it's basically how to do fascism without the military bit.
Yeah, yeah. Fascism through economics. How great. But that was designed by a think tank to indoctrinate children into neoliberalism. They used to give free magazines to corporations. If you worked for an ASX 200 company, you would get a free magazine. They published children's books.
Yeah.
And this the bread machine one, it is extraordinary. And it's all about government intervention destroys prosperity. And this has been a lot of people's cultural reality in the workplace, in education. You know, they used to replace the textbooks in university libraries and like give universities thousands of books for free so that people would be consuming just neoliberal orthodoxy. Like it's brilliant,
but
it led us very far away from a tangible appreciation of material reality,
which is
bad.
And the tangible reality is that in actual fact, government is the people.
Yeah.
We are the Commonwealth of Australia. The government is elected by the people. It serves at the pleasure of the people. And when we do have a functioning media class, we can hold it accountable.
Are you doing a segue?
I think I am doing a bit of a segue because, you know, the suggestion from the neoliberal ideologues was that government was something separate. It was that unions were something separate. And for a long time, I think media reinforced some of that thinking. Whereas the reality is, government is the people, unions are its members, and how the media engages with the people will actually form the views of large chunks of people who may not be engaging on a day-to-day basis with elements of the government or elements of their union or whatever it might be, but it will create for them a certain type of reality. And I think, Van, you know, you're the expert on this, I'm not, but some of the misinformation that's come from not just online but mainstream media in recent days shows not just how at a macro level it's dangerous for economics, but how at a micro level and a day-to-day level it could be dangerous for individuals as well.
Well, I mean, the key lesson is that politics flows downstream from culture, which was the line that they used to found Breitbart, that Steve Bannon and that gang in the United States really appreciated, that if you built it, they would come. Like if you built a bread machine, in their case,
we built a podcast and thousands of people have come.
If you built a Breitbart, you were willing to say things that weren't true, and there was an audience of people who wanted to believe them, you could create a very tightly indoctrinated political community that you could mobilize to say, riot outside the Capitol building in Washington and believe that they were patriots at the same time they were overrunning a building and smearing feces on its wall.
Yeah, and calling for the destruction of the Constitution.
And the hanging of the vice president, who notably is not endorsing Donald Trump for president this time. So, I mean, the issue that we have this week, and I've written about this in my Guardian column, but it preoccupies me, is that social media is a bad faith information environment. And the opportunity that we had with social media for this amazing destruction of gatekeeping was realized in part. I'm very grateful that social media revealed that there was an enormous number of women in the West who were actually feminists and wanted to have feminist conversations. In fact, we were the majority, which was how women started getting jobs, being columnists and being listened to, was that suddenly there was quantifiable data going, hey, chicks are into this.
Yeah.
Yes, chicks are quite into, you know, rights and equalities for chicks. It's quite a chick thing. And certainly I'm very grateful for that. I'm very grateful for the fact that diverse viewpoints, marginalized communities were given the free tools of the internet in order to establish, you know, like discursive communities and have intra and extra community discussions about what was important to them. And that's been transformative in many, many ways. In terms of a liberal democracy where you want everybody to have the right to speak and to speak and to be part of the discourse and represented, fantastic. I think we have to realise that social media has just the lack of gatekeeping has meant that in addition to everybody coming into the castle, so have all of the raiders and pests. And
yeah, it's turned a corner, really, hasn't it?
It's really something else. And it turned a corner, I think, it turned one corner in 2016 where disinformation helped elect Trump. It's true.
Yep.
There were troll factories, professional troll factories of like Macedonian teenagers who were getting paid to make up stories about Hillary Clinton. This is all a matter of record.
Yeah.
It weren't particularly invested in the United States presidency one way or another, did what they were paid to do.
Yeah, but the $10 a day was good, right?
Yeah, and we know that happened. We know that the Russian government pushed disinformation. You should read my friend Nina Yankovic's brilliant book, How to Lose the Information War. She studies this. She's a disinformation scholar who advised Zelensky and the government of Ukraine on how to resist the Russians quite well, obviously. And she talks about Russian disinformation ops and how the Russian disinformation ops will sponsor opposing groups to cause discord so they can turn around with footage of two groups trying to kill each other in a Western country and go, see, look what you get if you get decadent Western liberal democracy, and look what happens if, you know.
And we saw that during the pandemic.
I mean, I wrote about this numerous times that anti-vax groups were being organised by Russian sympathetic operations from Germany.
Yeah.
Like they were the ones who determined the date and location of anti-vax.
Footage being sent straight to Fox in America.
I wrote about that for the New York Times as well. And we've seen it in Australia, in beautiful, peaceful, lovely, democratic, universally enfranchised Australia. It is happening, and it happened last weekend. What happened at Bondi Junction was horrific and terrifying for all of us. We are a peaceful country. I just every day I fall on my knees and thank God we have banned guns here because the level of damage that was done by a knife-wielding assailant was extraordinary. If that person had have had access to a gun,
an AR-15 with a 100-round clip would have done extreme damage.
Unbelievable. And yes, guns were present in the arm of a qualified, properly trained police officer who took appropriate action. And, you know, that image of the police officer trying to
resuscitate
the person that they just shot, I just thought was an extraordinary piece of. Just and it just really spoke to the need for professionalism and training and, you know, when it comes to firearms and all of those things, the highest, most, you know, protected category of ownership has to be firearms because they are so dangerous. I am so glad I live here and not the United States, and I think every other Australian is. The weekend was so challenging for all of us. I mean, I've shopped at Bondi Junction. Like, it's one of the world's most innocuous shopping centres. And it was terrifying. And
but the misinformation that came out.
But what came out of it, which I think was just truly stunning, was what I'm calling carnage opportunism, where literally within minutes of this event becoming a breaking news story, you saw bad faith actors turn a massacre into an actual war zone, and it was a war zone over the truth and information. And first we had your usual suspects insisting that the man with beard was obviously a Muslim terrorist on the basis of the beard, and that was a lie that went worldwide. You had influencers in the UK, someone like a conservative opinionator from a conservative news operation, directly just went, this is Islamic terror. Mm. Rachel Riley from Countdown, Rachel, I thought more of you, also jumped on this bandwagon saying, you know, this is what comes from saying the word intifada all the time. And drew a very poor conclusion. And it was just, it went completely viral, this Islamophobic attack, you know, manufacturing a rumor out of nothing apart from hate and stereotype. Mm. And obviously we know, and we knew pretty quickly, actually, that was not an Islamic terrorist. Mm. That was a complex individual. It's being investigated. The motive, obviously, the overwhelming number of women who were hurt suggest a gender-related act of violence.
And his father has actually said that he struggled to find a girlfriend and he resented that. And you know, it's not difficult to extrapolate from that that's possibly a part of the driving motivation.
But also, there's an investigative process.
Yes.
And we can see what we can see and know that we have the trained professionals who can make an assessment.
But there were also people saying that that he was Jewish.
Yeah, well, people. Let's talk about this specifically. So I watched this happen. I was working and got all these frantic messages from friends of mine in America asking me if I was all right, and was like, they were like, are you near Bondi Junction? And I'm like, in Ballarat, no, but what's happened? And they sort of shared these news reports with me. I was like, oh my God. And at the same time, a number of online influency people and they're just nobodies who follow them or who, you know, have created them out of their own will for them to exist. At the same time those tweets were up denouncing the perpetrator as being Islamic terrorist, we had the accusation suddenly appear that he was a Jewish Australian and this was an evil Jew. And I'd like to credit people like Cameron Wilson from Crikey and the White Rose Society and various other information researchers and anti-fascists on the internet who traced the origin of that claim. They even named him as Benjamin Cohen, which is, you know, stereotypical two Jewish names, put them together and create
Channel 7 used that.
Well, this is what happened, but it's the origin of where this came from. The origin was Simeon Boykov, who calls himself Aussie Cossack, who you may remember from such things as crazy anti-vax nuttery during the pandemic and, you know, like the Australian cooker movement. He's a celebrity of the cooker movement. He's currently living in the Russian consulate. Because he's evading arrest. He's hiding from a legal subpoena from the Australian authorities and has holed himself up in the... So literally the origin of it was an evil Jew was someone living in the Russian consulate. Wow. I mean, I don't really want to speculate about whose geopolitical interest it might be in to have, you know, to mobilise a group of Australians into a froth denouncing somebody as an Islamic terrorist, and mobilise another group of Australians into a froth denouncing somebody as a Jewish terrorist. But I was watching this happen, this madness happen online, and came across a tweet from the father of a 20-year-old UTS student called Benjamin Cohen, who was begging people to stop sending death threats to his son, because what had happened was the internet rumor that has been traced to Simeon Boykov was reported as fact, supposedly, by Channel 7. Twice named Benjamin Cohen and used the photo of the kid from UTS as the suspected terrorist. He didn't even look like him. He had a beard. You have a beard. Are you next?
Well, I suspect that will be the third multi-million-dollar defamation lawsuit that they're going to lose.
Oh, yeah, it's been announced. I mean, they were getting death threats. But this was the thing. Because of what has happened to Twitter since Elon, I love conspiracy theories, aren't they fun? Watch me shoot a car into space. I am not a Bond villain. Musk bought Twitter. Is that we're just seeing it's a complete destruction of authentication and reliability on a platform, unfortunately, that did develop a reputation for reliability. Back in the old days where you could only get verified if you had a claim to verification. Like it took me years. I'm a columnist for The Guardian. It took me years to get verified, and that was only because 4chan hacked my Twitter account and was pumping out porn under my name, which was... And even Twitter realised that was probably unacceptable and I got verified. But that was the kind of thing that used to have to happen to you. When it was back in the days, the old verification system, you knew that if somebody's name was on something, that they were accountable to what they were saying.
Yeah.
And the algorithm worked that in a breaking news environment, and I remember so many breaking news moments when Gabby Giffords was shot in Arizona, when Osama bin Laden was raided, when Julia Gillard gave the misogyny speech. All of those things occurred in a Twitter environment where the algorithm put the breaking news from the verifiable sources at the top of the feed, and you could develop a news picture picture as a citizen or, importantly, as a journalist while that was happening. Now, that doesn't exist anymore because Elon, yeah, man, who the media think they are? Sometimes they're really mean to me. Like, oh, just because I'm a widow and send my children to school because I don't want to get them indoctrinated as socialists like the other children. Like, just absolutely reprehensible, filthy piece of garbage. Hey, it was like, yeah, man, well, you can just buy verification and I'm going to take everybody's verified badges away. And if you've got a verified badge, you can just like be at the top of the algorithm, whoever you are, which means that, you know, Jason Bunch of Numbers and his friend Nazi Bill can dominate a news conversation when breaking news is happening. We're all still in the habit of going to Twitter to find out what's going on, which is how this crazy, absolutely confected Benjamin Cohen rumor was, like, its origin and got picked up by people in newsrooms at Channel 7 who clearly haven't got the memo that Twitter is not reliable anymore.
And I think too, Van, it's not just, you know, there are now multiple examples of this. And if I think about what happened on Sunday with the attack on the Assyrian priest as well, there was this sudden flurry of that it was, again, a religious-based attack, and investigations are underway about that. Chris Bowen has come out and said how proud he is of the religious leaders for calming the things down. There was a riot among some of the congregants, where there was some, hey, what's going on? Why is this happening?
And arrests.
Arrests, and you can understand people's frustration. But also, you know, we've just seen the Bruce Lehman verdict in the civil trial.
Well, the point that I make in my Guardian column that's about to come out or is hopefully out by the time you listen to this is that legacy media, the old mastheads, the old networks have been completely corroded. Their business model has been disrupted by social media. And social media, you know, it's parceled everything up, it's split everything apart, and the economic impacts on legacy media have been extraordinary. Mm. And, of course, we end up in a situation where legacy media, which exists on this notion of reportage and investigation and telling the truth and exposing the facts, has been challenged by this medium where anybody can say anything at any time, which is now worse because Elon will promote you even if you are Jason
Bunch. Breaking news. You know, I studied journalism and you're being first and being right, you know, that was the order. Be first and be right. It wasn't be right and then be first. It was be first and be right, you know, and that's hard in an environment where your news gathering sources are now Jason Bunch of Numbers and Bill the Nazi.
Yeah, I hate those guys.
Yeah.
I hate those guys so much. I don't know if listeners to the show have figured this out, but I've really got a problem with Nazis. Like, it's quite intense. Yeah. And I think we should do, as a society, literally anything to shut them down and shut them out and totally marginalize them. I think if you're like, hey, man, I'm going to be a Nazi, your marginalization is really what you deserve.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
On set point. And just the, oh, my God. So, but we're in this situation where legacy media has taken a hit because of, you know, social media offering these free, limitless frontiers and consuming news for free and disrupting advertising models and all of those things. But what has become really clear in the wake of the Lehman trial, and I think that this is sort of the key takeaway, is that there's a huge appetite in Australia, actually, for news to be right.
Yeah.
And the Bruce Lehman defamation case, where he, after having been, you know,
mistrialed
out of prosecution in the case where he had been accused of raping Brittany Higgins, and that became a mistrial because of juror misconduct, because they went to the internet to read more about the case, which just really says everything. Don't go to the internet, full facts, please, Jesus. Anyway, he brought defamation proceedings against Channel 10 and Lisa Wilkinson, saying that they had defamed him in a story where his name was not mentioned, that a reasonable person would infer that he was the rapist. And, of course, what happened in this, you know, difficult, demanding trial that had all of these revelations about, you know,
Channel 7
wanting to get the interview of the century and being willing to sign checks for quite an extraordinary number of things, really, to meet Mr. Lehman's demands. For a good time, that on the balance of probabilities, the judge Michael Lee found that Lehman was guilty of rape.
Yeah.
And so you lawfully can say the Bruce Lemon is a rapist. That's what we've gotten out of that trial. But also in that trial, a really important assessment was made about media and about modern media and about legacy media, about the fact that the advocacy journalism the Channel 10 were doing to break the story and have the discussion needed to be contextualized within an inch of its life in terms of its legal support. And the judge made the acknowledgement that Lisa Wilkinson's speech about the story that they had done at an awards, and presently I can't remember which awards night it was, but it hadn't been legal properly, and it should never have been. The thing she said should not have been said because the legal team should have been onto it. And Margaret Simons, who was writing for The Guardian this week, a very, very story journalist, Margaret Simons, and saying, you know, there will always be advocacy journalism, but what does that mean? And what is journalism as a discipline? Like, it's about identifying what advocacy is and how that is separate to reportage and facts-based journalism and investigations. And she describes it, it's hard to do. Like, journalists aren't without their personal opinions, but the discipline of journalism is to put them aside, you know. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, I have the privilege of an opinion columnist. I get paid to spout off, but one of the reasons I get paid to spout off is me spouting off is a space that is identified, that is, you know, that it's opinion because it's got the word opinion written on it in big letters, which is very different from reportage.
Yeah.
And the two are a balance. Good opinion means that you only use the facts that come from reportage to inform what you think about and what you say. And by the grace of God, I hope I manage that as an opinion columnist. But it's,
I think, after 10 years of successfully being at The Guardian, we can say you have managed to do that on you know, consistent basis.
I try.
Yeah.
I do really try. But what is really important, like, is that the recommendations that have come from the judge and the consternation about the media environment and the need for legacy media to be on it, in my opinion, is an opportunity for legacy media to get their advantage back. It's expensive to have these law cases. It's bad for brand damage. It's bad for reputation. And my point is, if you want just opinion and just a very loose relationship with the facts, Channel 7, why would you watch commercial TV when you could just go on the internet and look at no facts and no, and just absolutely spurious conjecture and rumor? Like, the opportunity in the wake of the Lieben trial is to go, our brand is solid facts, investigation, a delineation between, you know, advocacy and crusading and reportage and fact finding and investigation. And as entities, we're in a position to make that, to make those labels and distinctions and articulate them so people know what they're getting. And I think that in this country, in the wake of what happened in Bondi Junction, to see two communities, two minority communities in Australia, the Muslim community and the Jewish community, essentially set up to, you know, with, you don't even need a conspiracy theory of, you know, one bad faith actor orchestrating two teams to fight one another. You just need a lot of, somebody had a brilliant line the other day, that Twitter has become Pornhub for angry people,
right?
You know, which I think is possibly the best description ever. But the idea that there were people on the internet invested in channeling hate and division and discord affecting minority communities in the worst play possible while Australia was reeling from an absolutely incomprehensible tragedy tells you everything you need to know about why you can't trust social media at all, because we saw it, because we knew it wasn't true, and why the opportunity for legacy media is to double down on being trustworthy in the wake of what the Lehman case identified.
And it's, you know, we're going to move on to the good news story in a moment, but it also, it's interesting too, Van, because one of the motivations for us doing this podcast was our own frustration around much of the legacy media and around much of what we saw on social media, and the need for working people to have an outlet where they could get information that was true, that was through the lens of working people, and that talked to their lives and about the impact of policy and day-to-day decisions of government on their lives, and the decisions of media and what they cover and what they don't on their lives. So it's to me, it's almost interesting that here we are, what are we now, nearly three years later, that the circle has sort of come all the way around now where you've got a judge saying, hey, you need to look at this. This is you've got a problem here that you've got to solve as an industry, and hopefully the Australian media industry is up to it. You know, Kerry Stokes is a billionaire, but you know these defamation cases are going to add up. They're going to keep adding up, and eventually, he does have some shareholders, and you would think some of them are going to get sick of paying out.
But also, you and I are very upfront about where we're coming from.
Oh, totally.
Like, no one out there thinks Ben and I are reporters, do they? You guys don't think we're not reporting. We're not doing investigative journalism. Like I said, it says on the tin, I'm an opinion writer, and I made the point when I began writing columns for The Guardian, I made a decision that I would always be absolutely open about my ideological allegiances, and I wouldn't pretend to be anything apart from what I was, because I think my readership have the right to understand me in context, and that I shouldn't need to. I'm not going to pretend that I'm impartial, because I'm not. I'm not remotely impartial, because that's my job.
And we've been very honest about that on this show. You know, we promote unionism because we are unionists. You know, we are from working class backgrounds, and we talk about issues for the benefit of the working class. That's our viewpoint. We don't hide that. We use facts. Of course we do. We use ABS facts. We use IMF facts. We use OECD facts.
Ben loves those charts. Oh, my God.
We use facts.
I'll put a graph in front of this man.
All the time. And we analyze those and we offer opinions. You know, you've analyzed some you know, legal cases and offering an opinion. That's what we do on this show. And we encourage listeners of The Week on Wednesday to do the same thing. You know, you're all entitled to an opinion. The more informed your opinion is, the better it is, quite frankly. Even if you disagree with someone, if you've looked at facts, if you've discussed them, if you've engaged a wide variety of sources, if you haven't relied on one tweet from one person that just reinforces what you already thought, then you're ahead of the game, in my view. And that's what we try and offer at The Week on Wednesday. But Van, there's good news, because despite Elon Musk launching Teslas into space or whatever it is he's doing now,
send him to Mars,
there is now solar vehicles.
Oh, solar vehicles. This is so good. There's a company.
Tell people.
Yeah, there's a company based in San Diego in the United States, quite sunny San Diego, relevant detail. They've done a partnership with an Italian company.
Yeah.
And they're building a car which is solar powered. It's amazing. And they're in the prototype stage. They're going to go on market when they've got 10,000 of them to sell. They are incredible to look at. They're like some of the cars you find in our favorite game, Fallout 4, but without the nuclear energy part because they're solar.
Yeah.
But they're little three-wheelers. And I'm showing Ben a picture of them here. They're incredible. They're designed as three-wheelers to minimize drag. They're absolutely this sort of efficiency model of, and they've got 32 square feet of solar panel on them. So essentially the car is charged when it's parked and when you're driving it.
Fantastic.
It is. It's fantastic. And they're getting there. So they're just in this new phase of prototype production. And when they get to 10,000, they'll go on the market.
This is the kind of good news we like to see. And, of course, we have had some good news stories sent across. Obviously, we've been off air a bit recently. We will get to some of those as well. You know, one of the things that has helped keep me going while I've been sick for months, and I know, Van has been in Sydney and coming home to look after me, is just how many of our supporters, people who listen to this show, who share the show, who write to us with story ideas or just to check in, but also who do make a contribution. Those contributions are still going into advertising. Our Google ads have been running the whole time, whether we've been on air or not. People have been downloading the back catalogue because of the contributions that some people have made. Whether it's $5 a month, that's our buck a week supporters, $10 for our Extend the Reach supporters, or $20 for our cadre. All of that money goes into helping more people get this information, to get these opinions, which are based on facts, which are extrapolated from analysis of the facts, and that encourage people to stand together in union to get better outcomes. And unlike last episode where I read it out quite poorly with my croaky voice, Van is now going to read out our cadre and extend the reach supporters.
Elizabeth Walsh, Karina Haythor, Brittany Slab, Janet Ryan, Riley C, Sue Schlesinger, Roy Cameron, Jessica Davy 26, at J Domney, Jason Paristella, Hey Kim, Megachi Soros, Metrazis, Murray Bardwell, Ms. Deanne Weir, Shamila Lashal, Labour Academy Victoria, Ann Coleman, Jeremy Moe, at Roskenner 888, Bronwyn Cockington, Terry Butler, Harry, Helen Cummings, Gail Ferguson, Rosie Elliott, Lara, Rebecca Fanning for Longman, Joe Lockerty, Ailey Vance, Sasha, Mary M, at Deb Melbourne, Blagoya, Sanj Kelly, Love Your Work, Yeti, Claire, Donald Vaughan, Shane Horsfall, Damien Marley, Pam Roberts, Jason Dallas, Camille, Steph O, Karen Bad, Cameron Strauss, the Tra Dragon, Gabe Kramer, Stephen Aiken, Trish Corey, Marky Mark, Daniel at Crazy Keza, John DeHaan, Greg Miller, Kathy Birch, Evelyn Halibut, Shell M, Fiona McNeil, Arabella Bird, Julie Fairbairn, Bron Bell, Karina Barley at Like a Doc, Melanie Denning, Jody A, Bill Newton, Penelope Judge at Jed Carney, S. Wood, Louise at Diddums, Adrian Valente, Bronwyn, Punch Drunk Veteran, Jenny Forster, Seven, Sharon Kelly at Jane C. Campbell, Mazritzer at Carriedale 68, Richard Rivera, Frank Niehaus, Vito W, Cassandra Tui, Ian Hampson, No Twitter for Me, Kerry Arthur, Hannah Hondo, Louise Pratt, Matt Bush, No Relation, Andita Hannah, Pammy, Rosalind, Bresh Daniels, Danny Payne, at Cheyenne and C, Maury Louise Hawker, Megan Weckert, Erica Pizzuti, Kylie Phillips, Kathy at Cosmedia, Graham Oxley, Tracy Lucas at Leanne Shingles, Gail Vest, Greg Martin, Trainer, Amy Fawcett, not on Twitter, Kate Andersara at Carrie Nash 20, Cassandra Tui, Eliane and Andrew, Billy Three McCabe, oh, for goodness sake. You're right. Ivis Billet, Donald Vaughan, Joe Lupino, Lucy Borden, Narissa Simon, Peter O.C., Sam Hadid, Meryl, Keir Patterson, Pauline Bate, Rachel Fitzpatrick, Lauren Ash and Banzo, Bunkum Busher, at Narunga Man, Stuart Mann, Sam, Katie Ward, Sandy Baumgartner, not Sandy B, John Sharp and Jess Believe, Peter Barth, Prince, Brenda, Teresa, Louise Watson, Just Me Davies, and Erin Kelly.
Those are our cadre and Extend the Reach supporters. You know, it's all of you. This will always be free to download and listen to this podcast. Like it, share it. If you do have a spare dollar or two to chip in, please do consider helping support us, growing our audience. I couldn't believe that the first episode back after so many months, we stayed in the top 40 for politics all week, and in fact peaked into the top 20, just on number 20 as well. It's all because of you. Congratulations to each and every one of you for making a real difference. And of course, joining your union. We get messages all the time from people who've joined their union, who use this information. And a shout out to the MUA delegates in Sydney who use our podcast to help educate some of the new young members about what it means to be a unionist, about the broader state of unionism, about the broader state of politics and the economy. Hopefully, you'll get a lot out of this episode and many, many more episodes to come. For now, that's all. I love you, Vanny.
I love you too. Bye. Bye.